Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today's conversation is one that gets at the heart of what it means to care about your city, not just in theory, but in practice. I'm joined by Ariana Martinez Lott, a community organizer, candidate for Fresno City Council District 7, and someone who has spent years working at the intersection of neighborhood relationships, public systems, and real lived experience. We talk about everything from how child development shapes the way she sees the world, to the realities of organizing across cultural differences, to what it actually looks like to represent one of the most complex districts in Fresno. Along the way, we get into Manchester Mall, parks, Fresno City College, Measure P, and the deeper question of how local government can actually work better for the people it serves. And of course, we hit overrated versus underrated, including bike lanes, charter schools, Don Pepe's burritos, etc. This is a conversation about systems, but more importantly, it's about people and what happens when you start with relationships instead of politics. Let's go meet Ariana Martinez Lott. Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! Ariana, where do you like to eat? Fresno?
Jordan, I am a creature of habit and I'm a homebody. So my favorite place to eat in Fresno is honestly at my living room couch with my husband when my kids are away with the grandparents, eating probably a burrito from El Premio Mayor and watching one of our favorite shows.
Okay, ¿qué tipo? What kind of burrito do you get at Mayor?
You know, I do the traditional carne asada, okay. Not the supreme, just the good old basics.
Yeah, let me say this about burritos. I am deeply influenced because I went to school in San Francisco for college. I'm deeply influenced by El Taqueria's like approach where there's no rice or anything in there, and it's just like meat and guacamole and a few other things.
Oh,
that's fine sometimes. There is a couple burritos I like. So for you, what are the ideal like extra components beyond the meat in a burrito?
Exactly. I am so glad you asked that because I think a lot of people don't understand. If I don't have three key ingredients with the burrito itself, I've got to have a whole lemon. Not a half, a whole ass lemon. Lemon, a Sprite, and a side of chips. All those combinations together.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about a bunch of things beyond burritos, and we're going to start with a couple kind of background education questions. I always like to start there. So I know you studied child development at Fresno State. I'm curious how that lens affects the way you see the world. Are there certain things that you can, there's certain ways you look at problem solutions, your landscape of Fresno that is affected by wearing that lens of child development?
Yeah, actually, there's a couple of components that have really just led to where I am today and the work that I do with organizing. My brother was born with Down syndrome when I was 12 years old. And so that was a bit of a shock to my family. And I think by that time, I was very aware of what was going on around me. And my family is, they're immigrants from Mexico, and just they experienced a lot of prejudice while living in this country. So they really like just sheltered us as a family. And we just kind of kept to ourselves a lot. I was not really in a world where we were a part of a much larger community, much like I am today. And when my brother was born, I think that was like, I didn't realize it up until a couple of years ago, processing like how much that really impacted my life of and my family's of just being put in a new reality where we had to be aware of understanding somebody else's needs that were different than ours. And so that's actually what led me into pursuing child development because I was going on the route to be a special education teacher. And I remember just while going through college, just realizing how much of our shaped environment impacts so much of our outcomes, not just within our homes, but the systems, our school environments. So there was a lot of me unpacking my own lived experience through my college experience that later on, as I continued doing this work, it was like, oh, how are we looking at the individual beyond just individual circumstances?
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because I encounter this in working in K-12 education for so long. I often will be communicating things to my community that are science focused, if you will. Like a child development is a science ultimately, is what you're learning. But often when you're doing work in the community, like you've done in the past, whether it's Every Neighborhood Partnership or whatever, you're working with communities where culture might come into conflict with what, you know, whether it's science, social science, behavioral science, whatever it is. And from my point of view, I often see it as a communication problem and a translation problem. But I'm curious for you how you articulate best practices or science when it comes into conflict with culture, whether it's how we raise kids or how we think about the value of homework or whatever it is. Like, how do you
Yeah.
communicate that?
Jordan, I think that's something that just has, even in my own personal experience, I've had to develop a lot of self-awareness on to be able to get to that point. You almost need to create like this separate layer, right? In order to recognize that cognitive dissonance, you'd be able to have to step back and say, okay, what's going on deeper here? And I think that's the challenging part is that we're too quick to jump into making assumptions about certain communities. Without having, I think, the self-awareness to be able to pause and say, okay, where is the miscommunication happening here? And I think that was even something that was really big for me as I was going through college experience, was even just making sense of my own upbringing. And even one example, when right after I graduated college, there was also a really pivotal point in my life where I was becoming a Christian. Having grown up in a traditional Catholic Mexican household, and there was this like dissonance of, am I allowed to pursue this faith that, from my family's perspective, and even from my own perspective, was a quote unquote white religion? And it took my family and I, there was a lot of just pain on both sides as we were navigating that. And to your point, it's a lot of more just cultural dissonance than anything. But yeah, that's a big part of this work in terms of how are we meeting community where they're at, and also us learning from that as well, and learning that we're operating in very American traditional systems when we're even stepping into this organizing work.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And what I've experienced is that people are too quick to skip over whatever tradition or practice that they're encountering, and they don't understand that whatever that practice came from somewhere, and it was a way to survive something. So you have to understand the practice in itself and what it's solving for before you try to provide another solution, because you might be providing a solution to a different problem than they're trying to solve originally. Anyway, we could go on forever with that.
Actually, on that note, Jordan, can I say really quick, Andrew File, I think he's going to be okay with me
Get
putting
him.
him on the spot right
Get
now.
that smiley guy. Tell him to stop smiling so much. Go.
I laugh a lot because when thinking about this work, Andrew File and I worked together in a lot of initiatives. And when we were both overlapped with Every Neighborhood Partnership, even just like in community organizing spaces, right? We have an agenda, we have certain things that we got to cover in meetings with community. And I just remember when we were working a lot with the Susan B. Moms, a lot of undocumented women, and they just do life really well together in relationship. And that's what brings us deeper into this work, right? And so we had a community meeting, and it was like an hour into our meeting, and Andrew was just sitting there, okay, are we gonna start the meeting? And he jokes about it because he recognizes his own cultural tension in that moment, and just like fully knowing, yeah, this is a part of the work that we oftentimes just don't know how to value in our traditional American space, US American spaces, I should say.
That's a perfect segue to my next question. I have had a number of community organizers on this podcast over the years, and I always like to ask them what skills they wish they had acquired if they had a time machine to go back. I think we have assumptions. We get into community organizing accidentally, almost, where we just see a problem and then we just go. Oftentimes, we're not really prepared for what it actually looks like to organize and operate something that's ad hoc and created to address a problem. And so when you think back over your years of community organizing, like if you could like drop one like skill set into your younger self that would make you a better community organizer in the long run, what would that be? Like, where would you stack your skills, if you will?
Absolutely. There was a really pivotal time in my life where I was really wrestling with community organizing amongst grassroots spaces and then also within nonprofits and some of the challenges that come with having to operate out of nonprofits in general. So, had I done one thing sooner, it would have been reading Adrienne Marie Brown's book, Emergent Strategy.
Okay, I haven't heard of this. Tell me more.
Yeah, I'll keep it very brief because it's just a book that folks have to read if we're operating in this world. Emergent Strategy, Adrienne Marie Brown just talks about how small parts play such an important role in our more collective large systems work. And sometimes we don't know how to value those small interactions, those small acts. And I was just really wrestling with there's just this real disconnect between what we're experiencing amongst neighbors, amongst community, and how that's translating into our systems work. And so I think she just really spoke to, I was at a time where I felt like I was being more of the problem than I was the solution because I was just angry and pessimistic about it all. And so I think I was very much operating under the sense of the only way that I knew how to function at that time was to just throw out the problems, throw out the problems. And so we got to be able to move beyond that, right? Yes, we need to be able to criticize systems, but how do we co-create these new realities? And I think that's honestly the one thing that I would have loved to do is just read her book sooner because it was just validating, honestly. Validating and just invited me into even just renaming my own tensions and saying, no, it is beautiful to be able to operate within these spaces that I feel like I'm constantly living in different worlds, not just culturally, but also just I do a lot of life with neighbors. And doing life with neighbors has literally been what has continued to push me on this journey where 15 years ago, Jordan, it's embarrassing saying it now, but 15 years ago, I would say oftentimes, I don't want to be involved in politics. I just want to help my neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I want for my politicians. That's a perfect segue. Let's talk about neighborhood stuff because there's a lot of people that just want to do, they want the latter more than the former. Let's talk about your neighborhood, District 7, which is a district that you're running for. District 7 is interesting. It's the most gerrymandery looking district in Fresno. It does really, because the original concept was the salamander, Jerry South. It was politician plus salamander is where that term comes from. But yours really looks like a salamander and it crosses through a bunch of different neighborhoods. When I'm looking at your area, do you agree with the statement that your area is the most complex to represent, given the shape and all the different areas that it connects with? It seems like it's the most kind of complex. Is that a wrong assumption on my part?
No, absolutely. I think you're validating just the internal turmoil when somebody asks me, like, where's your district?
All over the place.
Everywhere, everywhere. And the reality is, it's the newest district that got added onto the city, like in, I believe, like the 90s, right? And so ultimately, it ended up just almost like incorporating chunks of other districts to be able to, you have to have a certain percentage of population within each district. And so it is really complex. And it's also right at the core part of our city, which has had a lot of neighborhoods that have been even just systemically divided as freeway expansions got built in. So there are neighborhoods that have literally been separated from one another as neighbors within the district. It's
Yeah.
really hard to walk as a candidate because I'm constantly having to get back in my car, drive around the freeway, and then get to the next street. But it is really complex because, like, much like you can say District 3 is composed of Southwest, Downtown, Tower. We don't have that unifying identity as a district. And I think
Yeah,
it speaks to some of the challenges.
that's what I was going to ask is how do you think about representing a district that is so complex and diverse with such disparate needs? Because in your mind, you probably have to think about not the average constituent, but what is the organizing principle amongst all of these people that some of them might be like on the eastern side of your district, might be like living in new build tract homes. And then you have some people dealing with bad landlords and old crumbling buildings. So it seems like it's really complex. How do you think about representing a complex district like that?
Absolutely. I think for me, Jordan, the way that I've tried to enter into shifting from an organizer to now a candidate is, okay, what are the principles that I really want to put in the work to continue with me as a decision maker? And that ultimately starts with what my experience has been over the last 15 years, like listening to the people that are most impacted by these decisions and having that be the guiding principle. And so ultimately, with your question, I think for me, I haven't had to wrestle with it as much because I honestly am going into the neighborhoods more looking at it from a neighborhood perspective. So I always try to, at the very least, if I know somebody that lives in the neighborhood where I'm walking, I at the very least try and ask them ahead of time, hey, what's life like for you in your neighborhood? What do you like? What do you not like? And usually what ends up happening is as I'm walking each neighborhood, regardless of where it is in the district, there are common themes that come up at the doors. And so that is helping me at the very least as I continue to wrestle with what does it mean for our priorities as a district as a whole, right? And connected to the city as well. I'm more approaching it as how can I understand my district from the unique perspective of a neighborhood lens.
Yeah. Let's talk about there's this spot in your district that has been the source of a lot of hand-wringing for people, which is the Manchester Mall. It's a mall that's been in flux and is also the victim of suburban sprawl and businesses pushing further and further north and
Yeah.
east. What the logistics and everything else aside, what would be your vision for Manchester Mall, given that it is a central piece in that area?
Yeah, Jordan. I'll say that it feels very full circle now that I'm like an adjacent neighbor to Manchester Mall because that was where my family and I would go to for fun on the weekends. I was born and raised in Madera. And one of our best outings was when we would pack my dad's pickup truck with all my abuelitas and tios, whoever would fit. And we would head up to Manchester Mall on a good day when my dad was feeling generous. We would get to ride the carousel and then we would head over to Ole Frijole, where my grandpa would steal one of the little cups full of ice cream. And he still does, to be honest. So it does feel very full circle now because for the last 15 years, I have been a neighbor along the Blackstone Corridor. First on Belmont and Blackstone, and now I'm in the Fresno and Clinton area. So ultimately, like we know that it's not going to be what it once was, but Blackstone to me represents like a deeper symptom that we're all experiencing in Fresno, where the city just continues to build outward for special interest benefits. And it's really impacting us as a whole because when there's only so many limited resources, you've got to be able to focus it on where it's needed the most. Otherwise, it will continue to hurt the entire city as a whole.
Yeah, we could
And
be talking about
so.
Blackstone or Seder right there, but that's a whole different
It's
subject.
all connected,
It's all
man. It is all
connected.
connected.
So anyway, back to the mall. What's
But
your
the
vision for
mall, yes, I'm a Latina, so I end up having
the
to.
mall? No, yeah, I'm just curious.
The mall to me, Jordan, I honestly have been learning a lot from the people that have been doing the work in this. And how do we look at it as an opportunity to connect the different stakeholders that are there? You've got Fresno City College that is not too far from there. So it was really disheartening to hear when the owners are now reconsidering their commitment to investing in housing there, because that was a really core part of an opportunity to invest in housing where there was a market for it for students that are seeking this college education from all over the Central Valley, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we are able to really focus the investments in the type of infrastructure that is going to attract businesses in, we need to be able to give them some good faith that the city is committed to investing in that area. Otherwise, we're going to continue to be in the same position where investors aren't willing to back it up.
What is the state of the parks in your district? Are there certain parks that need some help and work? I know Fresno has some parks that have some issues. What for you and your kind of canvassing, what is the park situation?
I will say, I'm really thankful for the investments in Measure P. Because I think like we're seeing the needle shift slowly but surely. And I know we've all had a lot of just heartbreaks with Measure P in the recent months, but I will say, as a very active user of our parks and our community centers as a mom, I'm really hopeful. Because Romaine Park is, it's a couple blocks away from my house and we go to it pretty regularly. And so they've had a lot of upgrades recently that have been made possible because of Measure P. Now we have arts installations there, right? Right now they're renewing Holmes Park, which is not in the district, but surrounded by a lot of neighborhoods that are in the district. And so they're renovating that one right now. My park, my oldest is 7 years old, and she has literally played there her entire life alone, the majority of the time, because our neighbors have told me time and time again they won't take their kids there. So it did experience a lot of delays with construction, but I'm really thankful that it's now under construction. And it is going to require elected officials that are putting in the work to work with both the Parks Department and our community to ensure that these projects are moving on time. So that is the future that I really want to see more proactive engagement in when it comes to our parks.
Yeah. You brought up Fresno City College a second ago, and that's another just major key player in your district. Do you think the city should really prioritize infrastructure investment around there, just given that Fresno City College is really an engine of education for our community?
Yes, absolutely. And I think not just Fresno City College, but all of our education systems, starting from kindergarten. And that is one of the key things that we hear a lot from parents is that even though they live within proximity to their kids' school, they can't walk their kids because of the lack of infrastructure investments in our neighborhoods. And yeah, Fresno City College is raising so many of our kids that have gone through our education system. So there are a lot of opportunities to also strengthen, even making sure that transportation is accessible and free to all of our student population. That's something that I'm also like really committed to as well.
We're going to take a break from neighborhood stuff to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you, and I want you to tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Of
Órale.
course, you can pass on any of these if you don't want to answer them. We're going to start with the one I ask everybody, Mean Ed's Pizza.
Oh man, it's both. Can I say both?
Okay, you
I'll
can say
tell you what.
properly rated. That's a cop-out answer.
For my husband, it is overrated. So
Okay.
I hardly ever get it. So when I do, it feels like a classic.
Yeah. What's your order?
Pepperoni and pineapple with a
Okay.
side of marinara dipping sauce.
Fantastic. All right. Next one, protected bike lanes.
Underrated.
Okay. You think we need more of them? Why?
I do because we need to really expand our transportation system for different users. We've created a car-centric city, and I know that it's one of those things that whenever there is change, everybody hates it and everybody's
Yeah.
gonna be mad at it.
Yeah.
So that's
Because
one
it
of the
reduces
things.
the size of the roadway, and people
Yes,
are like, what? Why?
exactly. I get it, but at the same time, if we're gonna do things differently, we have to be willing to sit with the tension of even just having to inconvenience us as we have to go a little bit slower or take a different route. So, yeah, I know a lot of people don't like them, but I am a big fan of them.
Okay, you're in the middle of a political campaign. Political endorsements, are those over or underrated these days? Because
Overrated.
you see, people love to post them on their Instagram, political candidates. Why are they overrated?
I think it's all for show, to be honest. I think they bring a lot of value in terms of, yes, I do think that endorsements are very overrated because I think there's a certain political playbook that gets overplayed in our city. And quite frankly, the majority of everyday people don't have time to be paying attention to endorsements. They are trying to just provide for their families and just worried about what they see on their blocks.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, I do think it's a lot for show. And I think that oftentimes it also speaks to this larger problem that there are a few select group of people in power that get to dictate and in many ways influence who gets to be net quote unquote next in line, right?
Oh, yeah.
And to a certain extent, I really do think that endorsements can be a part of that problem. Whereas it should be how are candidates really showing up for the promises that they're making, where they've spent their time, who they spend their time with, and really answering to the residents that they're seeking to represent.
Yeah, it's some version of a good old boys network mixed with Nepo baby stuff. So we're not into that over here. All right, next one. You're at a taqueria and you're going to order a taco and they say corn or flour. What do you say?
Ooh, corn. I
Corn.
guess I'm a creature of habit. I'm a little afraid to go outside of a flour taco.
Yeah, I have those like when I do Sonoran style tacos, like it makes sense with what's included, but generally I'm on the same page with you. Next one, faith-based organizing.
Underrated.
Okay.
I think,
Because I've got mixed feelings on it. Like, I like it when it's not in your face, but sometimes when spiritual conditions are set for help, then I start to get a little concerned that we're using power to control people.
yes, or to evangelize them.
Exactly. But you said a little underrated.
I think it's
Okay,
underrated.
tell me,
It's
sell it to
like,
me.
I get it why Christianity has had such a bad rep, but I think I'm a product of a faith community that showed me what it looks like to for your values to drive your politics. And ultimately for me, I'm in this work because I'm not trying to evangelize anyone who's listening, but I believe in a Jesus who stood up and fought against political systems, who spent his time with people that were unhoused, with that I think the Bible has really clear mandates on how we're supposed to treat the foreigner and the widow and the prisoner amongst us. And we just don't see those models enough. I think people as a whole, we want something to believe in, whether it's faith, whether it's people, but we all want something to believe in. And I think that faith does offer that. It's just been really weaponized.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm watching that Senate race in Texas with James Tallarico, who's this kind of more progressive, really, he's in seminary or something, facing off against Christian nationalists. And so you have faith influencing these two different, wildly different perspectives. And it's really fascinating because I think in some ways they're fighting not only for the soul of the political system, but for the soul of the religion. What is it? Is it a tool for control? Is it a tool for liberation? So it's a fascinating world right now in the world of Christianity. All right, next one. Being really strict about screen time for children, over under.
Oh man,
What you
I'm a
got? Tell
part
me
of
about
the
your screen time.
problem. I'm
Yeah,
a part of the
tell
problem
me.
there.
You're like, just one more episode, please. Mom's got some stuff to do.
Underrated.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on screen time, given, what you've done for so long and working with parents and families?
I'll be very upfront with you. I think it's more just my husband and I's accountability to just not go towards what's easy because raising kids is hella hard. It's honestly more just like, how can we expose them to life outside of a screen time where it's so easy to do that?
Yeah, just give them alternatives as opposed to no. If you're telling your kids no and you're also trapping them in your house with you all day, it's there's the problem. Get them out and doing stuff.
And yes, to be very transparent, like, my homies, my little homies at the house, they do a lot of screen time too, but we try to limit it.
It is what it is. Next one, charter schools, over underrated.
Oh man. I'm gonna pass on this one because
Okay.
I am a firm believer that everybody's gotta decide for their own, but also a big champion for public schools.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, right? There's some good charter schools, there's some that are degree mills or really prioritize their output in terms of
I
college
will say this,
acceptance.
Jordan. I think
Yeah.
the public schools can learn a lot from the charter school model, and there's a lot that we can implement into the traditional education system.
Yeah, so maybe the answer is both. All right, next one, digital outreach versus physical canvassing. There's a lot of politicians that'll lean into their social media operations, and then there's a lot of they're just like, we're the boots on the ground type people. Where do you line up on that spectrum?
Yeah, I think because I'm an old soul at heart, I'm going to just say that's an area where I know that there's a lot more that we could do in my campaign personally, but I lean on the traditional face-to-face conversations. And I'm not gonna lie, I love canvassing. So like I wouldn't be able to meet turtles in person if I would just lean on more of the traditional social media. I've gotten to hang out with ladies that are have this turtle society, And people have welcomed me into their backyards to show me their gardens. And so there's just a lot that I wouldn't have been able to experience had I leaned more on the traditional or more modern social media outreach.
Next one, another fun one, community land trusts.
Oh, super underrated. I am
Okay,
so
so we need
excited
more
to
of
hear
these. We need more of
more.
these. Because let me give you the kind of the devil's advocate a little bit here. They have a big halo, but what is the actual scope of the impact? So that would be the devil's advocate. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I think for me, Jordan, I think we just need to diversify our approach in affordable housing in general. CLTs are not going to be for everyone, and they're not going to solve the affordable housing crisis. But we are at a really pivotal time where we cannot continue to do the same thing and expect different results. So for me, it's more like, how do we diversify our approaches? And yes, that is building market rate housing. That is also working with our traditional affordable housing partners. And that is also recognizing that there's a large growing network of CLTs and community development corporations that are also providing a different type of model that we could incorporate in Fresno.
Yeah, we need a portfolio, a package of approaches, not just politicians often will be like, oh, this is the magic bullet. And that we all know that's bullshit. Okay, next one, last one. Don Pepe's burritos.
Don Pepe's burritos, big fan of them because they put whole frijoles in it. I have something where, like, any taqueria, shout out to Don Tachas as well, downtown that puts whole beans instead of refried beans. Big fan of them.
Yeah, I like the, like a lot of people, and this was actually a guest recommendation, the shrimp burrito at Don Pepe's. I didn't know about it. Now I'm into it. Now it's all I eat. I don't know if that's a good, like one, just only eat one thing in your diet, but that's where we are.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
All right, let's jump back into Fresno politics out of that section. In the work that I did at Fresno Land on that podcast, we spent a lot of time covering transparency issues at City Hall. I'm curious whether you think the transparency issues are more of a system issue or more kind of bad actors within a system? And then what do you think we can do to improve our transparency?
I think they go hand in hand, Jordan. To be honest, I think for far too long, so many of the decisions being made at City Hall happened within its own little vacuum. And what we're seeing now, even just with more community engagement around issues like SADA, street vendors, I think it's a product of decades of organizing work that we're all just collectively trying to engage more people in the process. So this is just, I think the transparency issue is just a continued symptom of a practice that went on for so long.
Okay. Do you see the kind of the decline of the Fresno Bee and the fragmentation of the media market as part of the issue, like less accountability, or do you think it's also tied to people don't get the newspaper every day. People are the everything. There's so much distraction, social media and stuff. They're less focused on what's going on right here and much more focused on what's going out there, if that makes.
No, you know what? I don't know if it's because I've been in this work for 15 years, so I could only speak within that time frame, but I actually think that there's been more awareness and engagement amongst everyday people and what's happening locally. I think for at the beginning of my early years, even it just felt very like the local stuff felt just really disconnected in many ways. City halls. I think there's more awareness now of City Hall is literally impacting the way that our everyday lives are being built.
I agree
Plans
with
on
you. People are watching. It's whose narrative it is. And anyway, we can go down that rabbit trail for a way. I want.
But on the media side, I will say I think that there's different approaches too, that there's a lot of organizations that are working with a lot of young people now. And so they're finding non-traditional ways of reaching people that I think in the past we just didn't really see as much.
Okay. Let's talk about the nuclear issue right now at Fresno, which is Measure P. There's so much fog going on with this. We covered it at Fresno Land on the podcast quite a bit. And actually, our last episode before that show went on hiatus, RIP, was with Miguel Arias. And I think he maybe added a little bit more fog. Whether that was intentional or not is, I think that's to the listeners what they think of him. But I'm curious, like, some of the issues around Measure P have been process focused. There's a question of what is art. It sounds like the city council is going to be really pulling in and becoming a more central player in the Measure P stuff. So I'm curious, like, what would be your vision for how to correct some of the stuff that's gone on with Measure P? Do you think it's, what do you think the central issue there was?
I think a lot of it was what is pretty typical of the way that City Hall tends to function. I have a lot of respect for, in my time working there, I got to build relationships with a lot of staff. And what I appreciated about my time there was that I think prior to that, I had this perspective that, oh, City Hall is filled with people that don't care. They're just commuting in and they don't understand our neighborhoods. They don't care. And I was proven really wrong. And I'm really thankful for that experience because it's individuals that went into City Hall really desiring to just make a difference in their own ways. But they're also operating within a lot of political systems. There's elected officials that have goals of moving up to higher office, right? And sometimes some of the decisions, as we all know, are really just being dictated by more career politicians' ambitions. And I'm not talking about one particular or another, just in general, some of the decisions that are being made at City Hall aren't necessarily a reflection of what the community needs. One of the biggest problems is when we have this just common trend of so many of our decisions being driven by special interests and people's political careers. So it leaves a lot of departments really stretched thin with the resources to really do their work. And that's not to dismiss the real issues that have happened with Measure P, but I think it's just something to like, how are we creating systems that are intended to sustain? I know that there's a lot of arts collectives that had some really great ideas that we could implement, right? What would an independent review committee look like? How can we give more authority to the Measure P Commission to actually have authority to make these kinds of decisions where they're chosen because some of the expertise, right? And how can we make that process more transparent? So I'm really looking forward to, first and foremost, just sitting with community that's been carrying this work, not just in the Measure P implementation, but folks that are in these art collective spaces. Because one of the things that I absolutely disagree with is that it should stay within City Hall. That's when it's going to get caught up in the bureaucracy.
Oh, yeah. And that's my main concern. If I had two concerns, it would be one, the politicization of it, and then it's currying favor with politicians to support particular projects. And then secondarily, delays in funding where you have arts organizations that are on razor thin budgets. And if there's delays in the funding, it means job loss. It means programming stops for communities and et cetera, et cetera. We could talk about that forever. We have to talk about other things. So I'm curious. When you think about the role of city council, you have a bunch of different approaches to that role. There's people that really like to go to dioceses and tell people about things like their feelings on sexual orientation or whatever. And then you have some people that are just grinders that are just in the weeds a lot. I know that people like to cut ribbons. I haven't tried that, but I hear it's really fun. I'll maybe get some ribbon at my house. And I saw you can order giant scissors off Amazon, but I haven't done that yet. I need to do that. So when you think about a day, let's imagine you're in office and you have a day. Like, how do you think about what's the best use of your limited resources in a day? Just imagine a generic day versus something where you have specific tasks.
For sure, Jordan. I think one of the unique things that I am entering into this is having operated both within being deeply rooted amongst neighbors, amongst community partners, and having had the experience of working at City Hall. And one of the things that I left realizing was that What the most effective kind of council member is one that is also operating as project management. Because I saw firsthand where we were really engaged in the timeline of parks projects, of street repair projects, and understanding where that process was. And we were able to intervene when issues such as lack of funding came up, where there was a delay because of some kind of part, right? And communicating that to constituents. So that's something that I'm really excited about in operating as a council member that, quite frankly, I hope people don't see me a lot at ribbon cuttings because I'm going to set up the next council member to be damn well because it's making sure that these projects, they take a long time, are moving along and engaging with the residents. A big thing that I oftentimes say is, one of my biggest hopes is that at the end of my first term, there is more neighborhood-based civic engagement in different neighborhoods, especially the most disinvested neighborhoods in District 7. And I want to do that by having more gatherings at our parks, at our community spaces, because that kind of organizing starts when neighbors know each other. When neighbors know one another, we have each other's backs, and we start connecting the dots of, oh, you're frustrated that our park isn't fixed. So am I. Who makes those decisions? Yeah, I'm really thrilled about this opportunity because I look at it as like just a continuation of the organizing work that so many of us have been doing for long before I had the blessing of being invited into this.
Yeah. So you worked closely in City Hall, and now the goal is to be there as well. I guess my question is, how do you think about how the culture of a city council can change? I've read a lot of the coverage about how the city council operates, and somewhere between sclerotic and contentious and conflictual and all, I can come up with every adjective that means not as effective as I would want them to be. So how do you think, as entering this new space where you want to influence it in a positive direction, how do you think the culture of a city council can change and get really refocused on the constituents and not on squabbling and the climbing and all that kind of stuff?
I think a lot of that, even just from my own perspective, getting to know a lot of the staff in the different departments was really insightful and helpful because it helped me understand even just how I, as a staff, sometimes was a part of the problem in really trying to push our projects into the pipeline, right? Where they already have like a 3 to 5 year plan of the projects that are coming in. And also understanding, like with code enforcement, that's one area for me that is near and dear because they're such a necessary player when it comes even to like tackling some of our slumlord issues. And sometimes they are so stretched thin with their resources. We've got council members that'll bring in really good policies, but ultimately, does code enforcement have the mechanism set in place to really bring in that enforcement?
Okay. We close these podcasts each time with book recommendations. Ariana, what are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
So I have a couple. I already mentioned Emergent Strategy for anybody
Yep.
who's interested in this work. And then Homecoming is a story of two sisters, two half sisters that were born in Africa. One ended up marrying a slave trader, and the other one ended up being sold into slavery. So it just covers 8 generations and just really beautiful and powerful story. And then the other one is 100 Years of Solitude. It felt like it took me 100 years to read. Yeah, but just phenomenal story.
Oh, yeah. You feel like you get lost in that little town. And some days I forget his name, the guy that's got too many inventions in his house. I feel like I'm that guy half the time. I definitely connect with him. All right, let's talk about what's on the horizon, what events, what's going on right now with the campaign. Where can we find out more information? Just give us the broad gloss on what's going on and where can we find out more about you?
Yeah, folks can follow me on Instagram and the website has a lot of information. We let folks know where they can join us because for us, challenging establishment politics, we're gonna win this race, but one conversation, one neighborhood at a time, and really relying on our volunteers to help make that happen. So yeah, social media is where I try to put a lot of our events coming up.
Okay, fantastic. Ariana, thank you for talking with me.
Órale. Thank you, Jordan.
Fresno's best.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.